Well, if you've been with us these last few weeks, you'll know we've been looking at various Old Testament characters to see what we can learn from them as we watch them going about their daily work. Most of them have been pretty well-known people, even though some of the incidents we've looked at perhaps may not have been some of the best-known ones. But this week we come to Nehemiah, and although we have got one person here who became a Christian through discovering Nehemiah, I just lost where he is at the moment, but actually I think for most of us, we may not be too familiar with who he is. So I thought perhaps a quick rundown of who he was may not be a bad idea to start with. For me, I'd been a Christian for a year or two by the time I first came across him. And I was going to a church which had a building project on at the time. And they decided it would be a good idea if all the house groups had a few weeks looking at Nehemiah in the run-up to it. Now, I've subsequently discovered that this happens quite a lot, and it's a fairly common theme. There's a few people smiling at me, so you may well have come across this yourself. But I think this makes us think that Nehemiah looks a little bit like this, a sort of, you know, building site supervisor who the Jews have drafted in to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And I guess there's an element of truth in that. But as somebody pointed out to me the other week, what self-respecting building site supervisor would draft in the priests and the perfume makers to mix the concrete? So he's clearly no ordinary building site supervisor. And then we get this next picture of him that we see at the end of chapter 1. He describes himself as the cupbearer to the king. So what does that mean? Well, has he started off his working life as some sort of wine waiter to the rich and famous? No, not exactly. Because basically, the cupbearer to the king is the guy who had to make sure he tasted the king's wine before the king himself drank it. So if there was poison in it, he'd be the one to die rather than the king. So far from being a simple wine waiter, he was actually one of the king's most trusted servants. So if we want a picture to best sum up Nehemiah, the best I could come up with is something like this. Personality-wise, you may be able to spot a few differences between Boris Johnson and Nehemiah. But if you read on to chapter 5, verse 14, it becomes clear that the incident that John's just read to us is actually Nehemiah getting himself appointed as governor of Judah with the express mandate of rebuilding the city of Jerusalem. So basically, he was a politician, really. So that's who he was. What was the situation in which he was operating? Well, if you fancy it, you can actually discover it yourself by having a look at the two books of Ezra and Nehemiah between them. It doesn't take that long to read them, so you could easily do it on a journey home from work, particularly if you skim through all the long list of names that you find there. But very briefly, the Jews had been exiled to Babylon about 150 years or so beforehand. And then the Persians came in and took over Babylon, and a certain amount of repatriation of peoples had taken place. So the Jews went back, and with a few ups and downs on the way, the initial group, under the leadership of Zerubbabel, who was the governor then, and Jeshua was the high priest, they rebuilt the temple with the encouragement of the prophets Haggai and Zechariah. But that was now about 70 or 80 years ago, so quite a long time had elapsed between then and now, and all the initial enthusiasm and energy had long since gone. So the story of Nehemiah starts in a situation of doom and despondency, as Hananiah and his men tell Nehemiah of all the mess that's going on back in Jerusalem. And then it goes on to tell the tale of how Nehemiah goes back and rebuilds the walls, and in conjunction with Ezra, the teacher of the law, they usher in an age of religious renewal. So it's actually a fantastic story. In many ways, it could actually be the script for a Hollywood movie. And nowhere is that more true than the bit we read today through to the first half of chapter 2. So that's going to be the main bit that I'm going to be looking at this afternoon, as it sets up a pattern that's repeated time and time again as you go through the book of Nehemiah. But keep your Bibles at hand, because I am going to take a whistle-stop tour all the way through to the end of the book, just to take in the final scene. So just be prepared for that when we get there. But primarily, I'm going to be talking in the bit that John's just read to us. So if we go back and have a look at it, as I say, there's a pattern that tends to get repeated time and time again in Nehemiah. And it's actually an incredibly simple pattern, almost so simple that I feel a bit stupid pointing it out. But at the same time, it's a pattern that if we take it to heart, it's something we can remind ourselves of in any and every situation we find ourselves in. So how does it start? Well, Nehemiah hears about all the trouble in Jerusalem in verses 1 to 3, and he's absolutely distraught. And then straight away, verse 4, he prays. He actually fasts as well, but perhaps that's a sermon for another day. So let's just leave it at praying for now. So he hits the problem, and straight away he prays. Not exactly rocket science, you'll agree, but nevertheless, it probably doesn't happen nearly as much as it should. Now, we can look at his prayer and notice all sorts of things. He acknowledges who God is. He pleads to be heard. He repents of both his own sins and the sins of the Israelites in general. He reminds God of his promises. And he finishes by asking for something very specific indeed. So there's a lot to learn from how he prays. Yet on the other hand, there's plenty that remains a mystery. For example, you can look into the prayer as much as you like. And interestingly, there's actually no real clue as to when the moment came that he realized he was going to have to ask the king to go back to Jerusalem to rebuild it. As the action man he is, he may have decided straight away that was what he was going to do. But if you look closely at the timings that you see at the start of chapter 1 and the start of chapter 2, and if you know your Jewish calendar as well, you'll see there was actually 4 months between hearing about those problems and then going to see the king. So who knows what went on in that gap? But clearly what we've got in verses 5 to 11 is merely a summary of what Nehemiah actually prayed. So there is a slight danger that you can get a little bit lost if you look too deeply into the nature of his prayer. The critical point I want to make isn't about how he prayed or how he received guidance from God. The critical point is that he did pray. And it actually looks like he was praying for the best part of 4 months. Because you see, the thing is, when you look at Nehemiah, you cannot help but notice the fact that he was a man of intense prayer. Often his prayers weren't particularly complicated, and sometimes they can even make you wince a little bit. In fact, at times it makes me think, you know that sort of annoying phone conversation that happens when you're on the train or on the bus? You know, somebody sits down, and straight away they pick out the phone, and you get this monologue, well, they're probably talking already, but you get this monologue of all sorts of stuff. And then, you know, you might, for me, it's like I get into Victoria and suddenly you say, oh, just pull in at the station. Oh, you know, I'm going to get cut off in a minute. I'll give you a call when I'm out. And you know full well that what's going to happen is as soon as they get out the station, whether on the bus or walking, the phone's going to come out again and they're going to be talking. So it just goes on and on and on. Now, for those of us listening in, if you're like me, you can get very irritated by it. But on the other hand, for the person making that call, they know the person on the other end of the line. They know that they're happy to listen, and basically they just seem to offload whatever's on their mind. And if they pause for breath long enough, they might actually get some decent advice in return. And that really is how Nehemiah prayed, it seems to me. Just like that never-ending mobile conversation. He prayed like crazy. He starts that way in chapter 1 and carries on like that pretty well for the rest of the book. And he even prays at the moment in chapter 2, verse 4, when he has to go and see the king. It was his habit, it's what he did. So if we're going to learn nothing else from Nehemiah, if we remember to pray like him, we'll have probably learnt the most important thing. But the thing is, he didn't just pray. He also acted decisively as a result of his prayers. So chapter 2 then tells the story of how he plucks up the courage to go to the king with a clear intention of asking to head back to rebuild Jerusalem. Now, the full force of what he's doing may be masked to a 21st century European audience, but make no mistake, if this goes wrong, they could have his head chopped off. So he starts off by looking really down, which isn't what you would expect of the cupbearer. And then when he gets a glimmer of hope from the king in verse 4, as he says, what is it you want? He sends that quick final arrow prayer to heaven and then launches straight in to all the plans that he's clearly carefully thought through in advance. So when we hit a problem, prayer's great. It's essential, really. It's more than just great. But at some stage, we're going to need to take action. And that action will almost inevitably be shaped by our prayers. So, as I say, a very, very simple pattern that we see at work here. Hit a problem, pray about it, and act. And it was Nehemiah's pattern time and time again, and it can just as easily be ours. And then what happens as a result? Well, God acts in a miraculous way. If you just go to verse 8, you read the second half of verse 8, we're told, so chapter 2, this is, and because the gracious hand of my God was on me, the king granted my requests. So I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. The king had also sent army officers and cavalry with me. So as I say, it's pretty well like a Hollywood movie. There's disaster. Our hero, Nehemiah, prays. He risks death. But in the nail-biting tension, the king gives him more than he could ever dare hope for. and we see him riding off to Jerusalem, flanked by army officers to give him a safe passage. And I could send you back to your workplaces this afternoon and say, there you go. Whenever you come across a problem, pray about it, do what you need to do, and God will work miracles. And there's a sense in which I'd be absolutely correct. I may be taking a few liberties, taking a biblical example of deep theological significance and applying it into an everyday work situation, but you can look at a number of other places in Scripture and make a very similar point. So I think it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. But the point is, it isn't quite the whole story. Sadly, Hollywood endings are all too rare in the real world. Most situations actually end in tears. There may be some magical moments on the way, but the final scene is generally a sad one. Take the workplace, for example. It happens all the time, doesn't it? I guess there's still maybe one or two people who work their whole lives in the same company and retire happily, but it's pretty well unheard of now. For me, my last job in the commercial world ended up with my division being sold off, and I faced constructive dismissal as a result. And many of you will have had similar stories or far worse. Some may well be going through something like it at the moment. So that's on a work level. On a personal level, people get let down as well, don't they? You know, boyfriends and girlfriends come and go, marriages end in divorce, and many that survive become desperately unhappy. And, of course, you can go on forever, can't you? Your heroes let us down. In recent days, we've had Lance Armstrong. A few years ago, it was Tiger Woods. And if you happen to be a Crystal Palace supporter like me, you're probably still coming to terms with Dougie Friedman walking out on us and going to Bolton. Very sad state of affairs, I tell you. So if I say to you, when you hit a problem, do the right thing, pray about it, and God will make it okay, you're quite rightly going to turn around and say to me, yeah, get real. It doesn't work that way. But you see, the thing is, the book of Nehemiah says that as well. It says, get real. That's not quite the whole story. Sure, when he prays and acts, then God acts. That's perfectly true. But something else happens as well. And we can see this hinted at if we look back at the last sentence from the passage that we read earlier. Because we read chapter 2, verse 10, when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about this, they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. You see, if you go through Nehemiah, and indeed if you go through the whole Bible, you've got this extra point that needs to be added. When God acts, the enemy acts, or Satan acts as well. And as Satan acts, the situation gets very, very messy. And really, that's the reason why the world is so messed up. So I promised you a whistle-stop trip through the rest of Nehemiah, and here we go. Because I want to take a very quick look at how the enemy gets in the way. Sometimes it's blatantly obvious, and sometimes it's a little bit more complicated. It may be I go a little bit too quick for you to check up all the references now, but do check it out for yourselves later to make sure that I've told you right. So what we've got is we've got these two guys at the bottom of the problems. They're always Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official. So if you picked it up in chapter 2, verse 19, they then appear with Geshem the Arab. And Nehemiah says that they mocked us, they ridiculed us. And they do exactly the same thing at the start of chapter 4. And that then turns into a direct attack or a direct threat to attack the work. And then when this tactic fails, they resort in chapter 6 to what's described as scheming to harm me or intimidation. So it starts off pretty blatantly, and it gets just a little bit more subtle as it goes on. But the point is that Nehemiah seems to thwart them at every single attempt. So by the end of chapter 6, it looks like he's winning. Then by chapter 7, the war's completed. Chapter 8, the law gets read by Ezra. And then you head through to the end of chapter 12, and the war's been dedicated, and revival breaks out. So Nehemiah seems to have fought every battle in God's strength, and he seems to have won the war. So again, you could go all the way through to the end of chapter 12, and you still get your Hollywood ending. In fact, if you wanted to, you could actually make a series of Nehemiah films with him thrillingly overcoming the enemy at each and every stage. But, sadly, Nehemiah doesn't end at chapter 12. It ends at chapter 13. And if you know Nehemiah chapter 13, you'll know in the end that it's the harsh reality that seems to win out. Because basically, as soon as Nehemiah disappears off the scene, the problems start flooding back again, with Tobiah and Sanballat, the same old culprits, right at the heart of it. And the biggest tragedy, and it was interesting, I hadn't spotted this at all until I worked through the book, it concerns a guy called Eliashib. He actually first appears back in chapter 3. And if you looked at chapter 3, verse 1, you'll see that he's the high priest. And he's actually a bit of a hero, because he's the first person who's recorded as getting stuck into the building program. So he seems at this stage like a great guy. Then he disappears off the scene, other than a few brief mentions in the long list of people in chapter 12. But then we get to chapter 13. And in verse 4 of chapter 13, we read that Eliashib the priest had been put in the charge of the storerooms of the house of our God. He was closely associated with Tobiah. Now, it's not at all certain that this is the same Eliashib as chapter 3, because he's referred to as the priest rather than the high priest. But if you then head on down to verse 28, we get one of the sons of Jehoiada, son of Eliashib the high priest, was son-in-law to Sanballat the Horonite. And this definitely is the same bloke. So even if our hero of chapter 3 isn't now in league with Tobiah, he is in league with Sanballat. So it's almost as if the book's saying to us, just don't expect that happy ending, even though you personally might be able to escape all the darts that the enemy throws at you. Someone, in this case Eliashib, is going to get caught in the crossfire. And you can read through that final chapter and you see Nehemiah pretty well boiling over with frustration, because all his good work seems to have come to nothing. And he just tries to come to terms with the fact that as soon as his back's turned, the whole thing seems to fall apart. It may be stretching it a bit to say he was a broken man, but he was clearly very sad, very angry, gutted was an expression that somebody said to me the other day to describe him. So what do we take back with us into our workplace, having had the opportunity to see Nehemiah and his? Well, it is still true to say that when we hit problems, we should pray fervently, and we should act on those prayers, and we should expect to see God act. Make no mistake, that is true. We will be able to fight the opposition in the strength that God gives, but it won't be easy, and we may well end up carrying some scars from the battle. There is one final point that we should remember. Those walls, built by the priests and the perfume makers, they lasted about 500 years. So, in spite of Nehemiah's pain and frustration, he did actually succeed in his job. God's providence was still at work, and his ultimate purposes were fulfilled. So will we experience the Hollywood ending in this life? No, probably not. That'll have to wait until this age ends. Jesus told us to expect trouble in this world, so it's not surprising that the message of Nehemiah is exactly the same. But if you're tempted to give up and take the easy life, because you know that putting your head above the parapet just makes you a target, then do think again. Because the things which are of lasting value and the workings of God's providence generally only get seen in retrospect and not in the here and now. Because what ultimately counts isn't really whether we enjoy life or whether we appear to be successful. Those things are only temporary. What ultimately counts is whether we're faithful to God. And faithfulness to God is one area where Nehemiah, for all his trials and tribulations, was never, ever found wanting.